First, my apologies for being late for the ceremony this evening. It is not, since I'm the one who's often pointing out the ideal of how to practice, it's doubly not ideal for me to be late, so my apologies. It really isn't okay for me to be late. I'm not trying to, I don't want to set up that kind of double standard. So my apologies. I'll try to do better. And with regard to being late, it is not the end of the world that we're late. We're, you know, kind of, it arises that we get here late and all that stuff. So while it is good practice, nice, respectful of others to be on time, it does happen that we're late. And I just wanted to mention that if you do find yourself late, you come in and there's a ceremony going on, please come in and join in the ceremony as quietly and unobtrusively as you can. And if you happen to come in during meditation, though, maybe you could sit in the, you can either sit in the hall, I think there's a chair there, but in the room, there's another door out of the hallway downstairs. In that room, there's some chairs in there, and you could sit in that room until the end of meditation, and then come in and join us during walking meditation or at the beginning of the ceremony. So that helps to keep things, you know, quiet and undisturbed for the rest of us. Being late and making mistakes is a sort of, there's a nice connection to what I wanted to talk about tonight, which has to do with an aspect of meditation and training our minds where there's a quality of mind that we would be, you know, it would be helpful to look at, which is our ability to kind of create a story about our life and to kind of hold on to that story about our life even when it's in contrast to the reality of our life. And I'll connect it up to making mistakes and all that in a minute. Recently, on TV, they've been rebroadcasting on Masterpiece Theater the nicely done television adaptations of Jane Austen's work. I'm a unrepentant Jane Austen fan from many years ago, and it made me think that there is. And as I was watching it, it reminded me of a habit of mind that I have, which relates to this theme of creating stories, and that I thought was pretty illustrative and reminded me that it would be useful to talk about this. So as I'm talking, and I'm talking about my own personal experience, I'm really just trying to use my experience to illustrate an idea. I'm not advocating any particular mode of life. Okay, this is my disclaimer for today's Dharma talk. I'm not advocating any particular mode of life. I happen to be a celibate monastic and find that to be very helpful for my own personal training and very helpful in terms of what I find in my life, a very helpful way for me to train myself based on what I find in my life. And so when I talk about my experience, that's the kind of frame of reference that I'm talking about. I have no view that everybody in the world ought to be celibate monastics. Please believe me when I tell you, this is completely out of my, this is something that I never consider, that anybody other than myself should be in my particular state. So, with regard to Jane Austen, you know, I watched Jane Austen. I read her novels, and I think I can see myself kind of thinking, yeah, I want a woman like that, one of those Jane Austen heroes. This is the person that I want. This is the kind of life that I want. And I can see myself just going right into those kind of stories and thinking, you know, she's just, you know, really smart. They're sensitive. They're aware of what's going on, you know. And I think, yeah, that's the kind of life I want. But time and time again, I've proved it true for myself that life actually is not available to me. It's not. I mean, I'm not a minor aristocracy from the 18th century. Okay, you know, basically, if I were alive then, I would be a peasant. and so the whole kind of premise of me kind of fitting into that life is an imaginary premise. It's something that I has a level of unreality for my particular life that makes it clear that I could never have that kind of life. Now, it's to be discussed or thought about whether or not the ideals of kind of relationships that Jane Austen talks about might be applicable to a modern relationship. And that's another question which I don't really want to get into. But for me, that kind of life that I would imagine for myself, that kind of process of imagining a particular kind of life, is the area that I want to look at and explore a little bit today. So, so as we begin to meditate, we start to make a regular effort to practice meditation. We sit daily, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, twice a day, something like that. And we begin to see how our minds work, what goes on in our minds. And one of the things that you can begin to be aware of is a kind of narrative in your own mind about how you think your life ought to be, how it should be, the kind of life that you want and that you, in a sense, aspire towards. And you can begin to look at how that works in how you make decisions throughout the day and what you do with stress throughout the day. Now, there's two different aspects of this. In a sense, we start off practicing because we look at our life and we think, God, this is whatever it is. Sometimes we think, oh, this is awful. Sometimes we think, oh, there must be something more which I want to find. And so we start practice, in a sense, being discontent with the state of our life. And in that sense, we're taking that same faculty, that ability to imagine a life that would be better than the one that we have, and we're trying to find that particular life. When we encounter the Dharma, when we encounter Buddhism, it does an interesting thing, which is not common in the world, which is, in fact, quite uncommon in the world. The way the world works is that it is constantly painting a picture of how, an external picture of how a life can be. So you sit down and you watch TV, and all the commercials are telling you how your life could be if you owned this particular product, or if you went to this particular place, or you had, you know, whatever it is. You watch a television program and it tells you, in a sense, this is how the glamorous people live, or whatever it tells you. All of these things are sort of imaginary lives that we can kind of project into. What Buddhism does, instead of saying, here's a life which you can aspire to, an external form of life that you can aspire to, it says, the very fact of looking towards an external life is the thing which causes you discontent, is the thing which causes you dissatisfaction. And so the Buddha is constantly saying, turn around and just look at what you already have. Look more closely at what's already there. Look within yourself. That is where you can find peace. So we start off with meditation, we're sitting daily, and then we begin to say, okay, well, how can I bring, and you begin to find, oh, even though it's not entirely comfortable, this meditation process, there is something about it. There's something kind of going on with it, mysterious, ineffable though it may be, that that provides us with some kind of quiet, some kind of peace, some kind of satisfaction. And so as a natural outgrowth of that, we begin to say, well, how can I bring this sense of meditation into the rest of my life, into the rest of my day? And that process we do through the process of practicing mindfulness and awareness throughout the day, and the process of practicing working meditation. There's a nice article about working meditation that River Master Daisuke McPhillamy wrote, but the gist of it is, he says, you know, in terms of working meditation, in terms of what we're doing throughout the day, our process is to be aware of what we're doing, what the task in front of us is, and make that, in a sense, the focus of our meditation. So we're sitting, he uses the example of peeling potatoes in the kitchen. We're standing there, we're peeling potatoes, and our meditation practice is just to peel potatoes. So we just bring ourselves back to peeling potatoes. Our mind starts thinking about something other than peeling potatoes, and it's not relevant to making dinner, so we just let that go, bring ourselves back to peeling potatoes. And then he says you do that, 100,000 times. often that's the case with how distracted we get. That process of working meditation actually works with very complicated kinds of activities. You know, I'm sitting on my, one of my jobs recently is to redo the website, the OBC website. So I'm sitting at my computer, I'm talking to a lot of different people about this. And I bring that same simple principle to my working meditation. I'm just going to focus on what I'm doing. I'm going to let go of what my distracted mind. I'm just going to bring myself back to doing what I'm doing. And that process of bringing myself back over and over again is how you bring meditation into your daily life. Being still, being aware. Now, in the process of meditation, in a sense, we can talk about meditation as in a kind of simplified way, where we can just say something like, oh, just let it go. But there's, in a sense, also more, and that is a true thing to say, it's a true thing to do, just let it go. But also, in a sense, there's more going on in terms of meditation, in terms of training ourselves. Because part of what we're discovering, let me take a little sidestep for a second. In terms of our general theme about, kind of setting up an ideal picture of how life ought to be, an ideal story about how life ought to be, and then moving toward that thing, in a sense, practice is still making use of that capability that we have, and what we're doing is we're taking on board the ideal of, or the aspiration to become enlightened, to become a Buddha, and we're saying that's the story of my life that I'm going to, in a sense, follow. I'm going to make spiritual awakening the place where I'm headed. And what that will look like, who knows what that will really look like, but I'm going to map out a thing, a picture of what that will really look like. I'm going to be still and let go of things throughout the day, or whatever it is. I'm going to work on my greeds, hates, and delusions. I'm going to let those things go. I'm going to act on truth. So this is our general picture of where we're headed. And that's a useful picture to have. It's kind of useful also to know that it's just a picture, and we're going to need to let that go eventually as well, even though we're going to let it go while we're headed in that direction. Okay. Because in a sense, what the Buddha is talking about is actually living in truth, living our daily life in truth. In the truth, in the reality of life, the deepest reality of life, and giving expression to that throughout the day. That's what happens when you're sitting there working and you're doing your job, whatever that job may be, and you're just letting go and doing what is in front of you to do, what needs to be done. That is literally the life of the Buddha. Okay. I remember Master Hariya, the head of our order, he said one day, if you want to become enlightened, and you drop something, pick it up. Just that simple. Because it's that action from the basic reality of life. But as I say, doing that, what saying that sounds quite simple and mundane. When we actually do that, a number of other things happen in our minds and hearts. Because our mind is actually quite expansive and has many capabilities, has quite a number of things going on in it. When we're just sitting still and being aware, there's this whole kind of realm of things that we're aware of. Now, it can be kind of distracting in a certain sense to get too overwhelmed, too kind of interested in that. So we just constantly refer to just coming back and sitting, just sitting, just sitting. But one of the things that we want to pay attention to is the pattern of our life, how we get distracted from that, how we get distracted from living in the basic reality of our life, how we get distracted from following the basic reality of our life. And part of that is studying ourselves and seeing what our pattern for distraction is. So as I say, for me, well, I think I've said it before, and you'll probably, in listening to me, you'll probably find out way more about me than you want to. I apologize, but it's what I have to work with. It's my experience, and so I'm just gonna have to tell you that stuff. So sorry. So as I said, I've said it on a number of occasions. My basic kind of set of problems in life are oriented around greed. That means that when I get into trouble in life, when I create suffering for myself, it's oriented around desire. And honestly, usually there's some kind of relationship issue going on too. So my apologies for that, but there it is. In looking at my mind, I have to come to recognize that and come to grips with it. As I say, in my training, my experience has been, it doesn't really work for me to have a relationship for whatever reason. It just gets too strange and distorted. So here I am, I'm a celibate monk, and that works for me. It was kind of strange. Before I became a monk, I was all kind of like, oh, I really need to have a relationship, blah, blah, blah. And finally I thought, no, I'm just going to put that down. And then I became a monk and I thought, oh, wow, you know, it's not like I'm not suffering anymore, but this is a lot better for me, personally. Anyway, and again, I'm not trying to advocate any particular mode of life, apart from the mode of life of letting go of the self, letting go of what arises in the mind, and living from the truth of our life. That's really the thing that I really want to point towards. Because that's really the thing that will lead us to being at peace with ourselves. So this business of having a narrative in my mind about how I would like my life to be is part of how I create suffering. because there's this kind of little insidious voice in my head that's kind of always saying, well, if you had that nice relationship, I listened to a song, I think, oh God, if I had that kind of nice relationship, then I'd be happy. And it works on this kind of level that is just so quick, just kind of arises, and it's just like so quick, I just know I would be happy if I had that thing. And I've been watching this for a long time, I've been seeing it for a long time, and I know now I am better at letting it go when it arises. Because I can see, oh, that's just the story that I'm telling myself. Okay. It's, in a sense, a nice fiction that I've created. It's not that it's not reflective of somebody else's reality, but it's just for me, it is a fiction that I've created. And also, we can create fictions about the particular life that we actually have, even if it's the life that we want. So, for me, being a monk, if someone comes to me and says, "Oh, I'm interested in being a monk," and more specifically, if they're actually kind of in the process, maybe they're a postulant, maybe they're a novice, they're kind of in the process. I kind of tell them, "Well, being a monk is like, in Star Trek, where you have Federation space and you have Romulan space. And being a monk is like living in Romulan space. And being a postulant, kind of in that transition period, is like living in the neutral zone." So when you start living in Romulan space, the whole culture is completely different than what's going on in Federation space. The whole orientation of things is completely different. It's not like it's better or worse. It has a particular function and it has these various qualities, but it's quite different. And before you actually get into Romulan space, you can kind of think of all kinds of ideas about what that's going to be like, what it's going to be like when you're a monk, what's it going to be like. And a really helpful teacher of mine once said, whatever you think it's going to be like, it's going to be completely different. Just whatever it is that you're thinking it's going to be like, it's going to be different. And the thing about it is, whatever life we are leading, that is actually how the same, we're actually all in that boat. We're actually all in that state. Whatever the future of our life holds, whatever we think about the future of our life, it's going to be different than what we think it is. It might be close, but the reality of it is going to be slightly different from what we think. That's just the nature of how the mind works. The mind is really great at picking, kind of creating a picture of what things are going to be, what things are like, what it's going to be like. But when we're actually living it, when we're actually on the ground, we're actually doing it, it's different than what we thought it was. And that difference is actually really important to note, to pay attention to recognize. I'm not saying we shouldn't think about how things might be, try to think it out and make plans for the future. Sometimes that's what is necessary in the present. But what we are really trying to do in practice is to let go of whatever is in our minds and really just be where we are. Creating a plan for the future actually can enable us to let go of what our minds are doing and just follow the plan in a certain sense. And then from that place of letting go, that place of stillness, which is not a static place. It's not a static place at all. I mean, when you let go of it's hard to describe, but the reality of life is that life is life. I mean, it's alive. It's moving. It's going. It's not static. When you let go and are just still, there's all kinds of stuff happening, and you need to make decisions and do stuff, and that's fine. So oftentimes, you make your plan, you're letting go, you're living, you're trying to be as still as you can, and it becomes apparent that you actually need to do things differently than your plan. And so from that place of being still and accepting what is, you make a change. You modify your plan and you go in a different direction. That's just the nature of life. it is when we hold on to wanting things to be a particular way that we miss the opportunity and miss the need to change directions when we need to change directions. So in other words, I really like Jane Austen. I really like the story that she tells about the possibility of relationships. And so I kind of hold on to that. And I miss then, by holding on to that, I miss then the reality of what's going on in a relationship, you know, as it's being played out on the ground. And I make mistakes because of that. I hold on to this conception of how it ought to be. I want things to be other than they are. It's a kind of desire. And further, I mean, wanting things to be other than they are is actually pretty normal. You know, it's just, you know, particularly when things are suffering, that's a pretty normal state. What happens is we cling on to wanting things to be other than they are, and then we compound suffering. But when we're making meditation be the basis of our life, then we're just continuing to work on letting go of that wanting and grasping process. More able to live in that place where we can move forward in truth. And part of meditation, the deep part of meditation, maybe the deepest part of meditation, is just simple acceptance of what is. Just sitting with what is. Now there's a subclass of this kind of process of creating an ideal for ourselves, creating a story for ourselves, and then holding on to that ideal or moving forward in that ideal, which is the idea that we should be, that we're supposed to do some particular thing in our life. You often hear this, particularly among people who are spiritual seekers, like, oh, this was supposed to happen to me, or, oh, I'm supposed to be with so-and-so, or I'm supposed to do such and such a thing in my life. Like there's some kind of preordained process going on, or like, you know, in a sense, maybe God has kind of set this out for us. And it's a tricky business that's supposed to, when it has that kind of cosmic kind of quality to it. It's a tricky business because, you know, in a certain way, for me being a monk, I kind of had the feeling that, you know, the Buddha kind of grabbed me by the ear and said, okay, it's your turn now. Because there was a part of me that just really felt like I couldn't live my life honestly without doing this thing. But I recognize now that really doesn't have anything to do with the Buddha. That doesn't really have anything to do with the truth of life. That has more to do with my own conditions and my own need, the quality of my life as it is, just my life. There isn't anybody who's saying, this is what you're supposed to do. It's kind of scary in a way, but it's actually the truth that I can do whatever I want. I can take off my robe and walk out the door and live a life of integrity, live a life that is true from that perspective. There will be consequences for taking off my robe and walking out the door, but I can live in truth in that decision. I don't want to. I mean, I want to do what I'm doing. I'm just saying, we are completely free in a way that is pretty sobering and a little bit scary, in a sense. The degree to which we have free will is quite profound. We can decide to do something completely different. And boy, that's a really great thing, because there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in my mind that's really pretty squirrely, and if it's kind of telling me what to do and I have to live in that with that stuff, it's pretty great that I'm able to not be bound by it, not be bound by the way my mind thinks my life is, if that makes any sense to you. So the whole notion of I'm supposed to be doing a particular thing is suspect. Let's see. before I became a monk, I worked a lot as a baker for whatever reason. I need to earn a living. I like to cook and bake. I dropped out of college. So I worked as a baker. And I had this sense, and you know, it's again that kind of cosmic thing, that there's been, if I think about it, and I think, oh, there are a number of past lives involved in how I am. A lot of those past lives were people who worked as bakers. And, you know, I'm actually pretty, it's not just pride, I think, I'm actually pretty good at being a baker. I mean, I was actually pretty good at it. And there's a level of that which is just like, there's kind of being a baker is just part of me. There's a kind of like this organic quality to it where I get into a bakery and I just kind of know what to do. Part of that is just training and being, you know, kind of aware and all that stuff. But there's something more about that. And in a way I can think, oh, in the past I was really good at being a baker, and so that's really what I'm supposed to do. It's likely that if I were not a monk, that's probably what I would be doing, running a bakery somewhere. But that's a different thing than what I'm kind of supposed to do. We all have various skills and abilities and things which we are doing, which we're good at. And part of that may be, one explanation for that might be past karma, one explanation for that might just be the way that our minds work, that sort of thing. It's just really, and we shouldn't necessarily resist going in those directions. That's not what I'm saying at all. But just understand that there isn't anything that ordains it to be so that we should be in a particular, doing a particular thing, or be in a particular way, or be with a particular person, or anything like that. Now, if you read the life of the Buddha, that whole thing about being with a particular person, if you read the life of the Buddha and the Buddha's disciples, you hear some kind of interesting stories, like Makakasho, one of the Buddha's chief disciples. Let me make sure that was him. Yeah. He was this young man who was quite wealthy. At the time, it was important for, you know, as it is kind of the world over, for the son of a wealthy family to kind of produce heirs and carry on the family tradition or whatever. But he was really not interested in that. He really wanted to pursue spiritual life. And so he said to his parents were really kind of keen to get him married. He said to his parents, okay, well, I don't really want to get married. And they said, well, you know, okay, that's fine, but maybe you can describe the ideal woman who you would want to get married to. And Makakasho thought, oh, great, okay, so I'll describe this perfect person. And of course they won't find her, right? And so he makes this description of this perfect person, and his parents are like going, right, okay. Because they had a sense, Makakasho has probably been married in the past. So they went out and actually found the woman who fit the perfect description of Makakasho's wife. And so he figures out, oops, I've made the deal, I'm going to have to get married. So they get married, and then she's also very interested in spiritual life, so they actually don't end up consummating their relationship and agree to just go pursue the spiritual life. I'm sort of independent of each other. What I'm trying to get at here, and I'm not advocating a particular life, I'm just using examples to illustrate something. If you think about karma, past karma, it is quite possible that we could meet someone who we felt a deep connection to, and who we would feel like, oh, this is the person that I'm supposed to be with. Because, in fact, you have, you know, the karmic stream has been together for many lifetimes. And so that can happen. But as the example illustrates, it's not necessarily completely binding. Okay? Now, it may well be good. I mean, the Buddha did this. He in the same way, he describes his own relationship with his former wife. And, you know, he details his past existences throughout the Buddhist scriptures. And in every past life, he's been with this particular person, this particular woman. Of course, they get married, live together for a while, and have a child before he goes off and becomes a Buddha. it may well be good to be with someone. I'm not saying that at all. And we should just understand or consider the possibility that even though there may be this kind of close connection, it may not be good to be with someone. I've had this personal experience a number of times. But it may be good to do that. So again, my point is to really look carefully at this idea of I'm supposed to do a particular thing. I'm supposed to be going in a particular way, particularly as when things arise that feel kind of very strongly pulling you in a particular direction. I'm not telling you not to, I'm not suggesting that we should not go in a particular direction or that we should do any particular thing other than just continue to work on being still in those conditions. Recognize that we are free to make different decisions than we have made in the past. We are free to do things differently, to follow our hearts in this particular, at this particular time. And it is that process of looking within, being still, letting go of the stories and ideas that our minds create, that's what brings us to peace. And that in a sense, puts us where we're really supposed to be, whatever that means. And then the issue of making And then there's the issue of making mistakes. We do make mistakes. We do things wrong. We do create suffering for ourselves. That's one of the possible outcomes of our decisions. We can be going along, working on ourselves, following this process of meditation, and we can get the wrong, we can make the wrong decision based on the input, and we can find ourselves in a situation where we've just created suffering for ourselves. So when I came down to the meditation late this evening, I just mistook what I ought to be doing and got distracted, and so made some decisions that kind of brought me in late. And while I'm sitting there putting on my kesa, while the rest of you are kind of starting the ceremony, this was not a comfortable place to be in. Okay, it's kind of embarrassing. I'm the monk. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm sure Reverend Mester is not happy with me. I really hate it when people are not happy with me. This is one of my kind of issues or whatever. And so while I'm doing that, I'm sitting there, there it is. I've made a mistake and I've created some suffering for myself. It's pretty minor in the realm of suffering, but it's suffering nevertheless. And one of the difficulties of this meditation practice is, by extension, I'm going to have to be still even in the suffering that I've created for myself. I could think, oh, well, why doesn't he just wait for me to put on my kesa? I think, it's not his fault that you were late. No. So I'm not going to pursue that line of thinking. I'm really going to let that one go because I don't want to blame someone else for my mistake. Yes?
I was late also, as you know, and I was expecting to wait until there was a pause, and I looked over at you and you said, come on in.
Yes.
So I wonder if that was why you told me to come on in, because...
No, I told you to come on in because I truly mean it when I say it's not the end of the world that we're late, and if there's a ceremony going on, please come in and join us because that's what you've come here for, and that's really what I want to have. And I also want to create, I hope that we want to create an environment where people can actually make a mistake and not feel like, it's going to be the end of the world or whatever and all that stuff. So, I was just wanting you to come in and participate. That was my only reason. I'm sorry if that made you feel uncomfortable, and I apologize for that. Maybe I'll have to rethink that. But no, so I'm not trying to get anybody else to, I'm not trying to manufacture any situation for anybody else to feel what I feel. But what I'm just trying to point out is that it is by sitting still in it that I can learn what I need to learn. It is by sitting still in the arising of difficulty that I can learn what I need to learn. So if I have a particular habit of doing something, and I really make the effort to sit still in that habit, and that habit creates difficulty for myself and others, if I really sit still in that habit, then I can feel the consequences of it and see what's going on really. And in that way, recognize that, oh gosh, I really do want to be on time. Not because someone's kind of pounding on me or creating an unpleasant situation, but because this is the consequence, this is how it feels within me when I make this kind of mistake. Does that make some kind of sense? And in that way, we're again kind of grounding our life in the truth of our life, in the truth of what our experience is. Not in the ideal, not in some formal picture of what we think our life ought to be. I mean, in a certain way, I think to myself, I'm the teacher, I ought to be perfect. God, there's a lot of suffering in that. But the more I can actually just be there in the reality of who I am and what I'm doing, the more at peace I can be with myself. And that's the real treasure. So, any questions? Okay. Well.
All right. So, go home and do it, Dan. Thank you.
You're welcome.